greatest with respect to sexual transmission of Zika.
Thank you, Kyle. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm the last person, and then I think we may have time. Is it right we have time afterwards for Q&A? All right. So if there are a lot of questions, the ones you had also for Anita and Barb on Ebola, we'll have a chance to get back to them as well. I'm sorry. I think I'm brewing a cold, so I'm channeling a little bit of a Carol Burnett maybe or somebody down here. All right. So let's talk about sexual transmission of Zika virus, what we know, what we don't know. Just to remind folks very briefly, this is a virus that's the member of the flavivirus family. It's the genus flavivirus. It's a mosquito-borne version of these flaviviruses. There are two other groups, one tick-borne, one pestivirus, or that is a virus that's found predominantly in animals. I'll also remind you that in this same family are the hepatitis C viruses, which is interesting in terms of sexual transmission for those of you who are interested in sexual transmission of hepatitis C. It's a small, positive, single-strand RNA virus, tiny, 40 nanometers, in a little tiny genome, just 11 kilodalton. So much smaller, just a little piece of Ebola. We know that it is transmitted, if you're not watching the news, it's transmitted by a mosquito, Aedes aegypti, and could be by Aedes albopictus. We don't know of any other species that can transmit it. We know that there can be both intrauterine and perinatal transmission from a mother to her offspring. Sexual transmission, that's what I'll talk about today, has been well documented, and there has been at least one laboratory exposure where a worker was infected. It's plausible that blood transfusion and tissue transplantation could transmit, but we haven't had a documented case yet, although screening of the blood supply has certainly identified a number of infected units. A little bit about symptoms and onset. Most infections, probably 80%, are asymptomatic or very, very mild. Those who do develop symptoms, the onset is somewhere between 3 to 14 days on average. It's nonspecific, fever, rash, arthralgia, conjunctivitis. Very rare to have sequelae such as the variety of demyelinating syndromes that have been seen. Guillain-Barré is the one that's most well known. And we believe that past infection confers immunity to future infections after you've had it once. Our population of greatest concern is pregnant women because we know that infection during pregnancy is a cause of microcephaly and other severe brain defects. And a theme that I'm sure is very familiar to this crowd is the concern about unintended pregnancy. We really want to focus a lot of our attention both on pregnant women, but as well those women in reproductive years, knowing that in a survey recently published in New England Journal, 45% of U.S. pregnancies in women aged 15 to 44 were unintended. However, after recovery from infection, the same way that you are unlikely to be reinfected again, we also believe that that has no sequelae on future pregnancies in a woman who's had Zika infection. Sexual transmission of Zika. Wow, this is a new one. You know, I don't think till maybe the end of 2015, early 2016 this year, people paid any attention to this possibility. Now, there had been a case report published in 2008, coincidentally by a researcher who worked at Colorado State University, which happens to be adjacent to the CDC Fort Collins facility where we study Zika virus. Unrelated. But he had visited Senegal, came home, got ill. Subsequently, his wife, a non-traveler, never left the country, became ill. Some laboratory testing was consistent that both of them had Zika virus. Most likely, the mode of transmission was sex. We don't think that many mosquitoes come home in suitcases and transmit viruses. Around the same time, but a little bit later, in 2013, Zika was moving eastward across the Pacific, and in French Polynesia, there had been a gentleman who, after recovering from two episodes of illness, so he'd had one illness 14 days before his first symptoms, and another illness about 70 days before his first symptoms. We don't know which one of those might have been Zika, but he developed prostatitis and hematospermia. And he went to his doctor. The physician was a laboratory researcher with Zika, tested his semen, and found that it had virus in it. So this was the first evidence of, at least it was positive by RT-PCR. He also, though, tested culture positive at least at day 14 after onset of illness. Possibly day 70, we're not so sure. I mentioned the hematospermia. It was also present in the first case, but interestingly, that's not been a symptom or a sign we've seen in many of the other subsequent reports. And then starting in 2016, multiple case reports have come in from many countries now of travelers returning from Zika-affected areas and then infecting sex partners who did not travel. We've got reports now from at least 11 countries, including the United States. So what do we know about how Zika can be transmitted sexually? It can definitely be transmitted by men to both male and female sex partners. Interestingly, the first case identified in the United States was between two men. Zika can also be transmitted by a woman to her male sex partner. There's been one case. Zika can be transmitted through vaginal and anal sex, possibly fellatio, but of course, as you all are familiar, it's very difficult to tease out which sex act did what. But there happened to be a case of where the preferred method of sexual pleasure was intercourse, vaginal intercourse, without ejaculation, followed by ejaculation in the mouth. 7 times. So, this made New England Journal. I mean, come on, it's French. So I think fellatio was in the running, okay, but we haven't got it down. And then there's been a lot of concern about asymptomatic transmission. Recall I said 80% of people don't have symptoms. So how many men are walking around with this stuff and giving it to people not knowing they might be ill? You know, there's a detection bias. You have to recognize that a person developed Zika-like illness and had contact with somebody who wasn't sick but had been to a Zika area. There have been 2 cases like that identified, one in Maryland and one in France as well. Now, what we don't know? There's a lot we don't know. Well, we don't know if it can be transmitted between two women. Biologically plausible. Don't know if cunnilingus can transmit. Possibly. I'll show you some data that suggests that Zika is present in vaginal secretions. We don't know if the per-act transmission risk differs by anal sex, vaginal sex, fellatio, cunnilingus. And we don't know if symptomatically infected people are more likely to transmit than asymptomatically people. So do symptoms correlate with infectiousness? I think there's a first principle in infectious diseases that symptoms, the severity of symptoms often reflect the burden of the pathogen in the person's body. But with flaviviruses, that may not be the case. We're looking into that now. We haven't got a lot of asymptomatics yet to really know. We're trying to find out. All right, what body fluids has Zika been found in? Serum, whole blood, urine, saliva, genital secretions, and breast milk. Has not been found in tears. Mouse tears, yes. Human tears, no. All right. What do we know about how long it takes after symptoms to find infectious material in semen? Okay. As Barb and Nita alluded to, you know, a lot of the testing we do is RT-PCR. Well, that's showing you there's a piece of the virus present, but is it really replicative or infectious? So with semen, the longest time that we've been able to actually culture it out of a semen specimen is 24 days after a person's onset of illness. I mentioned that case in Tahiti where the guy had 2 episodes of illness. We're not sure which one it was. It could have been as long as 70 days. And I won't give away the surprise, but there was something published today that I put at the end of this talk that will place it a little farther out than it was right here. In terms of observed sexual transmission, where we know the time between symptom onset and first sexual contact, what's the longest time we've seen in that person who was sexually exposed became infected is about 41 days. So epidemiologically, 41 days is our outset. But you may all be familiar with these reports, these outliers, of a couple of men who've had RT-PCR positive semen specimens way out to 188 days. And of course, watching all this stuff about Ebola, I'm going, please don't make it 15 months. You know, I can't take this. But it's, I guess the point I wanted to make here are two. The first is that right now, the data we're dealing with are mostly individual case reports of very small case series. It's just like the situation that Ebola was in when we were just learning, and you saw that nice figure that Barb put up of what we knew about what it was in, and then all of a sudden, the edges got pushed way off to the left. So we don't know how representative these are at a population level. Furthermore, our publication process in the United States and elsewhere really favors publication of the exceptional. You know, if you have a run-of-the-mill series of people who just had Zika and got over it, that's less likely to get published than if you have this outlier. So there may be a lot of information out there, but we're not seeing it because it's not coming up through the publication process. So I wanted to show you the figure that accompanied the case of the man who had it out to 188 days to illustrate a couple of points. First, the semen in this picture is the yellow line. The blue line is saliva. The red and green lines are plasma and urine, respectively. And so detectable RNA declines rapidly in general in the plasma and the urine, may persist a little longer in saliva. This seemed to be a bit of an outlier, but look at this guy's semen. My God, it's out to 188 days. And really, of concern to us was that he fell to a negative test below the level of detection, but then came back up again. But I'll just point out, remind you, this is a logarithmic scale, and he was at very low copies per mil. These were generally down to around 1,000. And I think was it Ned Hook that brought up the issue around HIV? That, you know, we know that in people who are, and HIV is a great model where we know people who are durably suppressed can't transmit the virus. Yet when you look at semen of men who've been durably suppressed, you occasionally can detect RNA up to 2,000, 2,500 copies sometimes. So what this means in terms of infectivity, we don't know. But it's concerning a little bit that it goes out that long. All right, so what does detection of Zika viral RNA mean in terms of infection risk? There is another outlier out to 181 days. There was another one today of 153. There are a number of cases we've documented where the person's had follow-ups, and all attempts to culture virus from samples collected after 24 days, with the exception of the one I'll talk about in a minute, have been unsuccessful until today. That's how this just changes. It's like, ugh. How much of a risk does Zika in semen pose? Well, we'll have to correct this. It's has not been cultured from semen more than 30 days. It's going to be probably closer to 60 to 70 days now after illness onset. Only a few sexual transmissions have been observed, and most of these have occurred well under 60 days. And we can still detect it in semen over 180 days or 6 months, but we don't know exactly what that means in terms of the person's infection risk. So what we don't know is the incidence with which men who've had infection with Zika actually have it in their semen. What fraction of infected men, if they gave a specimen during their illness, would have it in their semen? How much virus is needed to transmit an infection? And how long virus capable of transmitting that infection can remain in the semen? Where is the virus replicating? Is it the testes? Is it the prostate? Remember, some of these guys had prostatic symptoms. We've looked at mice who seem to get it in their testes as well, so we don't know where it is. And what is the pattern of shedding? It sure would be nice if it were a steady decline, but these blips that popped up, you know, were concerning to us. And then what can we do to speed the resolution of virus in semen if a person's got it? You know, a not uncommon remedy for prostatitis is masturbation to try and clear the gland of the material. And is there something we could do in that regard that might be helpful if you have Zika in your GU tract? All right, cervicovaginal secretions. We know even less about women. And what's so interesting to me is we're all worried about women getting this infection because it'll affect their fetuses, yet all the research is on men, the vector of infection to women mostly. But still, you know, there are a lot of women who've had this infection as well, and we just don't know a whole lot. We don't know how long you can culture virus in cervicovaginal secretions. There has been one observed sexual transmission from a woman to a man who had sexual contact on the day she left the country. So the number of days between contact and exposure is zero. And there are two places where we have some insight into what may be going on in terms of viral particles being detected in cervicovaginal secretions. In a rhesus macaque model, I've put the figure here on the right. They had three female monkeys represented by the yellow, red, and blue bars. They collected vaginal swabs, endocervical swabs, and cervical mucus. And in the vaginal and endocervical swabs, they detected virus at 3 days, as well as the mucus. Then they detected only in the mucus at 11 days. And then by 14 days and onward up to 28, it was gone. There's also been a single case report of a woman in Guadalupe who went to her physician after having had Zika. Her doctor collected a specimen and found that a vaginal swab was positive at 11 days by RT-PCR, but did no subsequent follow-up. And I'll just mention that in many of these studies, having spoken to some of the individuals involved, it's not that the clinicians are delinquent in offering them the opportunity. It's just that people are sick and tired of public health asking for their bodily fluids, and they don't come back. So what is the risk posed by cervicovaginal fluids? Well, incredible falsity of data. I mentioned the single case in Guadalupe where we had a human sample. In the single female-to-male transmission, there were some interesting components to that for people familiar with STDs. First, the transmission occurred probably when the woman's viremia was peaking. We know it was right when she was starting to get ill, and we know that's when Zika viremia peaks. Her menses was imminent. No blood was observed by either sexual partner, but her period occurred the next morning, and the man was uncircumcised in this case. So what we don't know, again, a longer list, What is the incidence of Zika virus in cervical vaginal secretions in both women who are infected with and without symptoms? How much virus is needed to transmit? How long is it capable of transmitting and remain in those fluids? Where's the virus in the female genital tract? Is it reproducing in a tissue, or is it secreted, coming out of plasma and maybe into some form of solution? We don't know if it has a place where it's reproducing in the tissue there. And again, what is the pattern of viremia? Testing is an issue we face a lot. Unfortunately, right now for Zika, in contrast to Ebola, we don't really have testing we can trot out for people, everybody. Right now, testing is limited for the purpose of making a clinical diagnosis or surveillance purposes. So you have to have both. To be tested, you have to meet both an epidemiologic and a clinical criterion. You must have been to an area with Zika or been somehow linked to a person who may have had Zika, such as sexual contact with a traveler, and you had to have had symptoms that were within the time range you'd expect after that contact or exposure. We do offer testing now in the United States to all asymptomatic pregnant women who've either had a history of travel or residency in an active area, or who may have had sexual contact with a person who could possibly be infected with Zika. Importantly, we do not recommend at the present time testing to establish the absence of disease. False negative results, we're concerned, could be falsely reassuring. I'll walk through the test with you in a minute to kind of show you why we're worried about that. In that case, it may lead to an inadvertent exposure of a fetus to Zika virus, which is a very devastating, low incidence but high consequence event. So in terms of serum RT-PCR, it only lasts for a couple of days and goes away, and we know that men have had culturable Zika in their semen long after the blood is no longer RT-PCR positive in the serum. Serum IgM, there is no reliable IgG test that we're aware of right now. People are doing IgG testing, but there really isn't a good one that our laboratory people — I'm not a laboratorian, so I'm channeling what they would say — they don't feel comfortable that there's really a reliable one. So we rely on IgM, and that may go away after 12 weeks. In fact, we're not even sure if this frame I've put here of 2 to 12 weeks is accurate. Some people are saying maybe 2 to 8 weeks. Whole blood RT-PCR, very promising. You can detect the virus in a whole blood sample. It appears like West Nile virus. It may be associating with the red cell fraction, that there may be a ligand on red blood cells to which the virus, these flaviviruses, have a proclivity to bind. But is that living virus that's still circulating, or are these, again, virus particles that just bound? And then semen testing is not available in this country commercially. It's only available in research labs. There is no FDA-approved method for semen testing at the present time. There also are, among the 7 EAUs, emergency authorizations for using tests, none of them are for semen. And there really isn't a standardized protocol. You know, diethiol-3-3-etol, for those of you who are familiar with this, an agent that breaks down mucus. You know, should you use it or should you not use it? It's an interesting question we don't have any answer to yet. CDC is doing 2 studies to better characterize what's going on in body fluids, and one of the PIs is with us today, so if you have a specific question, she may be able to answer it. There's a U.S. study where men who return from a Zika-affected area and develop illness and are diagnosed with Zika are offered the opportunity to enroll in a trial where every 2 weeks for 6 months they can provide semen and urine specimens. It's done by self-collection in a mailer sent back to the lab at Fort Collins. I think they've enrolled about 150 men so far. The information for the project director, her phone number or email address are here, so that should you know of an infected man who'd like to participate and hasn't been approached, you're welcome to refer him to Allison. Puerto Rico is another place we're doing a study. It's called Zipper for Zika persistence, where both men and women are being offered the opportunity to enroll. I know, really, you get a great trip to Puerto Rico, huh? You get it all paid for. Where you can provide blood, saliva, urine, semen, and vaginal swab. They're trying to get both symptomatic and asymptomatic persons using a strategy of going to the home of a symptomatically infected person and then testing everyone else in the household to try and identify asymptomatically infected persons. Then they also collect samples over a period of time. This is the email address. What else we don't know that I want to share with you today, because these questions come up all the time. What is the contribution of sexual transmission to the burden of Zika infections? Most are transmitted by mosquitoes, undoubtedly, but how much sexual transmission is contributing in areas with mosquito-borne transmission is very hard to discern when both exposures are happening simultaneously. Can kissing transmit Zika? It's very unlikely, given the disproportionate male-to-female ratio of sexually transmitted infections. Intimate contact with a lot of kissing, you would expect a more even distribution of male-female, and we're not seeing that. It's a lot of male-to-female. Is Zika spreading unobserved through the population like some silent plague that's going to infect everybody through sex? Well, it's possible. Certainly, infections must be occurring that are asymptomatic. But it's unlikely to be a sustained phenomenon because it's a time-limited infection, which, unlike traditional STDs, can continue to be transmitted until they're diagnosed and treated. And in fact, I added a reference here today to something published in today's Lancet Infectious Diseases model showing that to get to a reproductive value, to sustain transmission, men would have to be able to shed infectious virus for at least a year. So don't think this will be something where sex keeps it going. And then, have there been sexual transmitted infections to pregnant women? And yes, there have. There have been women who were pregnant and they were infected by their returning sexual partner unknowingly, and we have a monitoring system to monitor for all of them. So in summary, Zika may be the first flavivirus observed to be transmitted through sex. It's important to understand this because of its relationship to severe sequelae and congenital Zika syndrome. We've learned a lot, but there are enormous knowledge gaps, and we really need these to inform our prevention recommendations, which I'll show at the very end. Key questions are, what are the correlates of infectiousness with viral titer in culture? What's the contribution of sex to the burden of disease compared to the mosquito-borne? And what's the biology of the infection in men and women's genitourinary tracts? And I'll just add, this is like Ebola. You know, there's a whole other discussion about how do you write prevention messaging around this? How do you balance the need to provide caution against the proportionality of people that you will be talking to? In Ebola, they have an audience of men who've all survived. So there's a fixed number of people you're talking to. For Zika, imagine how many men come back into the United States every month from Zika-affected areas. Our Division of Global Migration and Quarantine estimates it's 1 million men a month. We have other data that suggests that fewer than 1% of those people are likely to be asymptomatically infected. So any recommendation we make is going to be affecting a lot of person who really don't have the real deal, and we don't have a way to tell them whether they do or don't. So, you know, try to think about that and what will actually reach people and cause them to act in a way that would prevent a potential fetal exposure is very difficult. Lots of resources available. I will say one of the best things about Zika is that we were able to develop nice infographics of how to put on a condom for a man and a woman and how to use dental dams. So they are there. You can go to them at the bottom, and they're graphic. You have to get through a warning. Yeah. All right. What do we recommend for sexual prevention? These are the current recommendations from four authorities, and you can see that in terms of I've put the columns as pregnant women, people who are planning to conceive, and those not planning or able to conceive. Those are the three populations we speak to. Everybody says pregnant woman, no unprotected sex for the duration of the pregnancy, or abstain. But when you get to people who are planning to conceive or not planning to conceive or able to become pregnant, the time periods people recommend vary around two constellations, symptomatic versus asymptomatic. People draw a line there. And then men versus women. People draw a line there as well. I'll say that we are revisiting the U.S. guidelines right now, and we're in very frequent conversation with all of these groups, as well as Australia and the European CDC, because we would like to try and line up. We recognize it's confusing. I will note that WHO threw up its hands and just said 6 months for everybody. All right, data today that appeared in Lancet Infectious Diseases. All right, guy comes back from the Maldives, had a vasectomy. Damn it, he developed Zika, and they cultured it out of his semen at 69 days, but it was negative at 96. Vasectomy, no sperm, okay? In the same volume, same edition, the next page, a guy with Zika had sperm isolated. They spun it down, and with immunohistochemical staining, they're finding Zika particles inside the sperm. I don't know what it means. But, Well, this is really interesting, you know? And I'll just say that one other case, one of the asymptomatic cases, one of the two that have been documented, was in a couple that was undergoing assisted reproduction in France, where they routinely test people undergoing assisted reproduction. And this is a guy who was azoospermic. He didn't make sperm. And they found Zika in his semen fraction. So he was lacking the sperm. So I don't know where it is. And as I mentioned, you know, some of these guys have prostatic symptoms. I don't know. Maybe it's just all over down there. But we're going to find out. All right. So thank you for that. I think we can take some questions of the panel, and hopefully we have some time.